This is John Sanford, January 26, 1991. What every Jungian should know about Gnosticism. Tape 2 of 3.
CG Jung Society seminar on Saturday, January 26, 1991, at Kane Hall, University of Washington.
Some people have said that that's the Gnostic gospel. It isn't a Gnostic gospel. Christianity was a Gnostic religion. That's why it's there. And as I mentioned, these first Christian fathers were very psychologically oriented. They wrote treatises on dream interpretation. They wrote treatises on the nature of the soul, which are their attempts at depth psychology. And they looked at the scripture from a mystical viewpoint. It changed later. Great pity. And then, of course, when creedal formulations and got connected up to power structures, then you had great hostilities in Christianity between competing creeds, which are also connected to competing power structures. And so you got into the spectacle of Christians persecuting other Christians and things like that. It's just to be a very dismal picture indeed. All right, now, things got off to a good start here, but as you and I know, why things on our planet Earth are not all that great. So how did it happen that the material world came into being, that souls came into being, that evil came into being, and so forth and so on? So here is the story according to Valentinus, according to Irenaeus, and later, if we get a chance, we'll read some of the original texts to see if this account is accurate. It begins with Sophia. Now, you see, the Gnostics had a story of the fall, just like the Christians had a story of the fall. The Christians had to account for the same problem. How did sin come into the world? How did things get into such a bad way? How did people fall away from God? And so the Christians and the Jews also had the story, because it comes in the Garden of Eden tale. That's the Jewish version of how it happened. The Christians, who accepted the Jewish scripture, of course, looked back at the story of Adam and Eve, and they said, there is the story of the fall. Adam and Eve sinned. They ate of the forbidden fruit of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, and with that, this good world that God had created fell, and sin and evil came into being, and so forth and so forth. It's not a very satisfactory explanation, but it was the best they could come up with at the time. And so that was the Christian version. Well, this is the Gnostic version. And it centers around Sophia, whose name is a feminine name, it's one of the Greek words for wisdom. Now, it seems that among the 30 ions, only the ion nous that we have already commented upon could comprehend the nature of Boothus, the original all-encompassing father. Only nous could have this understanding. All of the ions, however, wanted to have this knowledge of the father. But they respected their limitations in this regard. Except, however, for Sophia, who was the last of the 30 ions to be created. Sophia, according to this one rendition of it, there are slightly varying versions, conceived a passion for Boothus, the all-encompassing father, and a passion for understanding the nature of Boothus, the father. This passion, this desire, was illicit. This was not allowable to her. And because of her transgression, the transgression of her desire to have this knowledge and this comprehension, she conceived in herself what was, and this is the Greek word that's written there in your handout, an enthumesis. There isn't any decent way to translate enthumesis into English. One might say it is roughly like an abortive desire. The enthumesis of Sophia was a chaotic substance, devoid of form. Like I say, roughly analogous to an aborted child. The difficulty was, you see, that since Sophia was only feminine and not masculine as well, she could give birth to substance but not to form. The idea in the ancient world was that substance came from the feminine, but the form of substance came from the masculine. So if you united both substance and form, then you had a substance with form. But if you lacked the one, in this case the masculine, then you had an amorphous, shapeless, formless substance. From this enthumesis of Sophia emerged material substance. Nevertheless, since Sophia was herself one of the all-spiritual, all-light ions, even her enthumesis, this amorphous material substance, contained within it elements of the spiritual light of the ions. Because of the grief of Sophia, which came from her inability to know the Father and from the unfortunate circumstances in which she now found herself, there emerged from her, as part of her enthumesis, ignorance, grief, despair, and bewilderment. Now, if all of this sounds difficult to follow, it's because it is difficult to follow. We just don't think like that anymore. But that's the way that people thought at one time. Now, the father, Buthus, seeing what had happened, realized that something had happened in the Pleroma which was illicit and which had gone beyond the bounds. And so some say that it was at this point Horus was created, to set the limits for things. Horus then was given the task of correcting what had gone wrong so that the Pleroma could be restored to its original pristine state. Horus therefore separated Sophia from her enthumesis. He restored Sophia to her proper place there in the Pleroma. But he had the problem of what to do with the enthumesis. It would be sort of like if the plumbing broke down in your house, what are you going to do with all the you-know-what? So he did a very reasonable thing. He ejected it out of the Pleroma, and then he drew a line dividing that which now had fallen below the enthumesis of Sophia from the upper world above. And this was the line of the firmament. And nothing from the world below, except under the circumstances we will soon see, was to be allowed to return to the world of the Pleroma above. All right, this enthumesis became, as we will see, the world as we know it. Everything in the world as we know it is formed out of the enthumesis of Sophia. All this chaotic material reality of Sophia. Now, first, before we get to that, we'll continue with what happened at the Pleroma. Following this step, the creation of Horus by Nous, Nous also gave rise to Christ and the Holy Spirit. Their function was to strengthen the Pleroma and prevent such further calamities. Christ at this point is not to be confused with the Jesus of the Gospels. Christ instructed the other ions in such a way that there would be no danger that any of the other ions would be tempted to follow the misguided passion of Sophia. The Holy Spirit talked on their equality with each other and guaranteed their future tranquility. Now you can see at this point that certain Christian images have been introduced into this Gnostic schemology. And you can always already imagine that this wasn't going to be greeted with universal enthusiasm by Christians. Thus joined together once again in perfection, the Pleroma expressed a great cosmic hymn. Out of the music of this hymn, said some, there emerged Jesus as a perfect expression of the Pleroma. So we got Christ, and now we have Jesus. If you're confused, then you understand the situation. Meanwhile, the enthymesis of Sophia had fallen through the firmament that formed the boundary of the Pleroma into the regions below. So now we'll see what happens. Now we're down to your next handout, the creation of the world. Aren't you glad I gave you a handout? Into this world below comes the enthymesis of Sophia, which is now known as Achomoth. Get a new name here. And is personified as a feminine being. Achomoth is a combination of the enthymesis, the material chaotic substance of Sophia, plus the spiritual residue of Sophia, which clung to it, and also was cast out of the Pleroma at the same time the enthymesis was cast out. Now Christ, whom we just recently met, pitied this Achomoth cast out of the Pleroma and consented to bestow upon the hitherto formless Achomoth the gift of form, but not of intelligence. Therefore, emerging from Achomoth came, as mentioned, the qualities of grief, fear, desire, and ignorance, because there was no intelligence. But there also came the capacity for form to combine with Achomoth to create a world of form, such as we live in. There also was created by Achomoth the demiurge. The word demiurge comes from a Greek word, demiurgos, which means an artificer, a skilled workman. Plato talks about the demiurge in his Timaeus as the world-creating divine power. So now we have the material realm, which now is capable of having form, and now we have the demiurge, which is as we will soon see, is a sort of a god without a capital G here, who is an artificer or a skilled workman. Now this demiurge promptly proceeds to create the world as we know it from its basic substance, which is matter. The demiurge himself had no spiritual nature. In all of the world he created, there was only material nature and animal nature. There was no spiritual nature except for the elements of spirit that had fallen into the world along with the enthymesis of Sophia. Of these lost elements of spiritual reality, the demiurge knew nothing. The demiurge is ignorant of everything that is in the Pleroma. The demiurge only knows the material world that he has now created. Because of the ignorance of the demiurge supposes that he is the only God there is. So when we read in the Jewish scripture what purports to be God saying, "Thou shalt have none other gods but me," declaring himself as the only God, the Gnostic said, "This is the voice of the demiurge." In his ignorance, he supposes he is the only God. He says this only because he knows nothing of the Pleroma, the upper world above. Therefore, you see, the God of Jewish scripture, the Old Testament from the Christian point of view, is not God at all. Is this lesser demiurge. So you can see there's going to be trouble. Meanwhile, emerging from grief came the devil and all manner of wicked demons and angels. Finally, the demiurge created humankind, created the human soul, who accordingly, the human soul, accordingly bore a material nature and or an animal nature. There were three kinds, well, we'll get to the three kinds of souls in a moment, but not a spiritual nature. But unbeknown to the Demiurge, Achamoth succeeded in implanting into the souls of some of these human beings elements of her own spiritual nature, which you will recall had been cast out of the Pleroma inadvertently, as it were, along with the residue of the enthymesis. Thus, there were in the world, according to the Gnostics, three kinds of souls: material souls, animal souls, and spiritual souls. This is not to say that every soul has material, animal, and spiritual qualities. It is to say there were three different kinds of souls. So you look around you and you will see over there is a purely material soul in that individual. That's the lowest. Over here is a purely animal soul. But over here is one of the spiritual souls. Now, you can't tell just by automatically looking at people, but it is a fact. In this way, the Gnostics accounted for the fact that some human beings seem to have a completely ignorant, brutish quality, while others had a notably spiritual quality. Thus, this lower realm, presumed presided over by the ignorant Demiurge, was material, completely ignorant, and it was the realm of evil. The upper world of the Pleroma was spiritual, good, and light. Now, the problem of salvation is how to get the lost spiritual element of Sophia that fell down with her enthymesis into the lower below and became part of Achamoth and wound up in the souls of certain people who were known to the Gnostics as the elect. They were known as the elect because they were the only ones who could be saved. Material souls and animal souls could not be saved. There was nothing to save. Only spiritual souls could be saved. The question was how to get those spiritual souls back into the upper realm. If they came back up into the upper realm, they would bring with them their spiritual element that was in their souls, and if all of them were saved, the Pleroma would be complete once again. All right, so how is that going to happen? Well, obviously the souls of the elect, which carry this lost spiritual element, as I have said, must be returned to the world of the Pleroma above. As long as they are not returned, at death, apparently in Gnostic thinking, those souls, spiritual souls, are reincarnated in other souls. Now, the idea of reincarnation is implied by Gnostic teachings, but as far as I can tell, it is very seldom explicitly mentioned. But I have found a few explicit references to the reincarnation of the souls of the elect who have not yet managed to be turned to the upper world. They get recycled until they are able to go back permanently to the upper world. Now, the way they get back into the upper world is by acquiring the true gnosis, the true knowledge. This true gnosis consists of two elements. First, knowing everything I've just told you. That's the gnosis. Of course, there's a good deal more detail that goes with it, you know. If you know everything I just told you, then that is the gnosis. So if a Gnostic teacher came around and instructed you, you would now be in possession of the truth about yourself. Wouldn't do you any good if you weren't one of the elect with a spiritual soul, though. But if you were, then, since you are in possession of this knowledge, You are now in a position when you die to carry this knowledge with you to the division line that divides the firmament, which divides the world above from the world below. And there, if in addition to this knowledge, there has been imparted to you the requisite names of the angels who guard the firmament to keep the unworthy from passing through, and of the necessary passwords and other secret information, then you, as one of the elect, with this knowledge, this twofold knowledge, could pass through and rejoin the Pleroma above. What's not too clear is whether you as an individual entity continue to exist, or whether the spiritual element that was embodied in you would simply blend in and merge with the ions above, but you as a particular separate conscious entity would no longer exist. I've not been able to find that out. Now, we'll get to the end here, and then we'll be ready for questions. Maybe a short break and then questions. Now, it should be observed that this gnosis bears no resemblance to what we would call today psychological knowledge or insight. It is not psychological knowledge. It is metaphysical knowledge that you acquire. True doctrine. Now, for a note here on the relationship of Christ to salvation in Gnosticism. As mentioned before, not all Gnostic systems embodied Christ in it. You could have this Gnostic system without Christ at all. You don't need Christ for this. But some of them incorporated the idea of Christ into their system, including the one I've outlined to you at the present time. And those who did, as I have observed, were the Christian Gnostics. I guess I've already described Christ to you. Yeah, Christ was the one who rectified things in the world above. Oh, yes. But, forgot, yeah, no. According to some systems, including that of Valentinus, to hasten the process of revealing this gnosis to the souls of the elect, Christ came down into the world below. Just like in the Christian idea, the Word of God comes down and into the world below. But in the Christian idea, the Logos, the Word of God, incarnated in a human body. In the Gnostic scheme of things, this would have been a gross idea. He only seemed to have a body. He had a phantasmal body. When he was crucified on the cross, the suffering was a feigned suffering. Or some said, Christ actually stood apart from his body and laughed at the tormentors tormenting his empty body on the cross, because that was not where he was. He could not have a genuine body because material reality was in itself evil and contaminating. So the mission of Christ was to kind of come down and to reach the souls of the elect and help bring this saving gnosis. All right, now I will conclude this portion by reading a Gnostic hymn. The Gnostics had hymns too. Apparently they met and worshiped and all those things, like the Christians did. And this is a Gnostic hymn, as recorded by Hippolytus here, now not Irenaeus. Unfortunately, we don't have the music. The world's producing law was primal mind. And next was first, that would be nous. And next was firstborn's outpoured chaos. And third, the soul received its law of toil. Encircled, therefore, with an aqueous form, with care o'erpowered, it succumbs to death. Now holding sway, it, that's the soul, eyes the light, and now it weeps on misery flung, because the soul experiences itself as in an alien country from the Pleroma. Now it wails, now it mourns, Now it thrills with joy at the hope of rejoining the world above. Now it wails. Now it hears its doom. Now it hears its doom. Now it dies. And now it leaves us, never to return. It, hapless straying, treads the maze of ills. But Jesus said, Father, behold a strife of ills across the earth, wanders from thy breath. But bitter chaos man seeks to shun and knows not how to pass it through. Knows man does not know how to pass through the firmament back up. On this account, O Father, send me. Bearing seals, I shall descend. He will seal the souls of the elect. Through ages whole I'll sweep. All mysteries I will unravel. And forms of gods, the ions, I imagine, I'll show. And secrets of the saintly path, styled gnosis, I'll impart. You want to take a break and then have questions and discussion? You've been very patient to listen to all that as you have. It's not easy to absorb that. So why don't we take a short break, shall we? All right, the Gnostics said that the created material world is evil. The Jewish, because it was created by the Demiurge, the Jewish Christian point of view was that the created world was created by the one and only God and was inherently beautiful and good. So they looked upon the created world quite differently. The Gnostics said there are two worlds that are irrevocably split from each other, the upper spiritual world divided by the firmament from the lower material world, and the two realms had nothing to do with each other other than this accidental fall and so forth. The Jewish Christian point of view said there was heaven and there was earth, but heaven and earth was all part of one reality. The Gnostic point of view said that this lower material world was created by an evil demiurge, none other than the God of the Old Testament. The Jewish Christian point of view said that heaven and earth were both created by the same good God. The Gnostic point of view said the lower world is material and that matter and nature are evil. The Jewish Christian point of view said that God created the world and nature and saw that it was good. You know, it's amazing when you run down this list how the Jewish Christian point of view is identical with each other. The difference, of course, comes with the issue of Christ. The Gnostic point of view said the upper world is spiritual and that this is sheer perfection. The Jewish Christian point of view said that the spiritual reality pervades the material world as well. There's not a separation. It pervades it. The Gnostic point of view said that human beings are of three kinds. They have material souls, animal souls, or spiritual souls. As we have seen, the material souls are the worst, and the animal souls are sort of in between, but the spiritual souls are the only ones who are good and are elected for salvation. The Jewish Christian point of view says that all souls partake of good and evil. And they say that the body is not evil in itself, but is the temporal home in which the soul sojourns in this life. Indeed, the Christians said that in the resurrection, the body is also raised, but becomes a spiritual body. There was no conception in Jewish thinking, and that went over into Christian thinking, that there could be a human being without a body. So in this life, it's a corporeal body, a material body. In the next life, it is a spiritual body. But the soul always exists in a body. So said the Jews and the Christians. The Gnostics said there was a tragic fall which led to the incarceration of the spiritual element in the souls of certain people, that these people are the elect chosen to be saved, and that the fall came through the passion of Sophia. The Jewish-Christian point of view, well, here this might be more Christian than Jewish, said this is a fallen world that came about through the sin of Adam and Eve, but there are no elect souls. All people are loved by God who works for their salvation. All people might not be saved, but if they aren't saved, it's not because they did not have a certain kind of soul. It's due to other factors. But they agreed, the Jewish Christian point of view agreed with the Gnostic point of view, that there had to be a salvation. That unless souls were saved by some agency, then in one way or another, they were lost. The Gnostic point of view said the evil has no purpose. It simply is that material reality from which one must escape if one has been elected to escape. The issue of sin was not important. For the because if you had the souls of one of the elect, you wouldn't sin. You might be ignorant, but you wouldn't sin. The prevailing Christian point of view, and probably Jewish too, was that evil had to exist if there was to be a world in which choice existed. Because for there to be choice, there has to be something to choose between. And that the highest development of the soul, which God intended, could only take place in such a world of choice. Only if people could choose evil rather than God, could they truly choose God. That was the argument. The Gnostic point of view was that salvation was achieved through gnosis, as we have seen. Faith was generally downplayed in the Gnostic scheme of things, and the Christians in their early literature complained that the Gnostics ridiculed them because of their emphasis upon faith. As we've seen, this gnosis was the secret knowledge of one's spiritual origin. There was no salvation was not a matter for the Gnostic of wrestling with good and evil. It was not a matter of having succumbed to sin and finding redemption from that sin. Sin was not an issue for the Gnostic. The Jewish Christian point of view said that souls needed to be saved because of sin. They argued that sin darkened the soul and obliterated consciousness, especially consciousness of God, and made the soul corruptible, subject to decay and to being lost. So the Jewish Christian point of view is a very sin-conscious point of view, much more so, for instance, than the point of view of Hinduism or Buddhism, for which the central fact is not the question of sin. This is a particularly Jewish Christian concern. In order to be saved from sin, the Jewish point of view was that a person had to meticulously fulfill God's law, but that God wanted people to succeed in this and would aid and abet them, and that they could always turn back to God if they strayed from the law and repent and renew their efforts. The Christian point of view despaired from humankind ever being able to fulfill the law and cast themselves upon the grace of God, which they saw manifested in the life and death and resurrection of Christ. With the Gnostics, as noted, faith was of no consequence. From the Christian point of view, and I think also the Jewish, faith and knowledge were not antithetical, but were companions. Faith nourished knowledge, or led to knowledge, and knowledge nourished faith. Faith was what you went on until you had knowledge. In other words, if you're a scientist and you think you have a clue as to why these atoms are moving that way, but you don't know for certain, you go on faith with your experiments. And then your experiments might then lead you to the knowledge. Which is why the words faith and knowledge occur almost equally in the New Testament. Faith was not identical in the mind of either the Jew or the Christian, because the Jew also had faith in God's saving actions and concern. It was not identical originally, as it is often today, with blind belief. Today, faith tends to be a category of the intellect, which is why Jung objected to it. Just believe these things. At its inception, faith was a category of the soul. The bottom line to the transference, I would like to suggest, is faith. The client brings faith into the analytical relationship, otherwise the client wouldn't be there, and places that ingredient of faith in the therapist and the process. Without that faith, there will be no success, probably will be no therapy at all. The therapist also must have faith that the process can work, which is why in Jungian thought we have analysts become analyzed. If they are analyzed and presumably is successful, then the therapist has a powerful ingredient, faith in the process of analysis. It's always best, you know, if analysts have originally been in a mess, psychological and otherwise, and managed to get out of it, sort of. Because then they have faith. With the Gnostics, the knowledge, as I mentioned, was a knowledge of the cosmic situation with the Jewish Christian point of view. Knowledge was knowledge of God, and among the best of them, the best of both the Jewish and the Christian spiritual people, it was also knowledge of oneself. The Greek saying, "Know thyself," was on the lips of all the early Christian fathers. Because the argument was that God was the most immediately known in the soul. It was interior knowledge. Therefore, one must know thyself, your own soul, in order to have a knowledge of the workings of the deity. Among the Gnostics, Christ was one of the ions who came into the lower world to rescue Sophia and to carry out a rather dimly defined world of instructing the souls of the elect. In the Christian point of view, and here this departs from the Jewish point of view, well, not entirely, as I will show you in a moment. Christ was the Word of God, the all-creating Word of God, who created all the world you see, but mysteriously was incarnated in Jesus and lived on in the soul. All of which is a great mystery. In the Jewish point of view, we have Sophia, not to be confused with the Sophia of the Gnostics, the wisdom of God, who in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, such as the Book of Wisdom in the Old Testament and other documents, Sophia was the world-creating aspect of God and assumed for the mystically minded Jew a mystical significance of a reality imparting God's wisdom to the person seeking God. In the Gnostic point of view, Christ never incarnated, really, because matter was evil. He had a phantasmal body. He only seemed to be a real physical human being. So this is called, in theological language, the docetic Christ, from the Greek word dokeo, which means to seem or appear. So the docetic Christ is the Christ that seemed to have a body, but did not really have a body. In the Christian point of view, why Christ fully incarnated in a human body, and that was through the mystery of being born through a human mother, through Mary. All right. It's 20 minutes odd. Now we have, want to have 5 minutes for questions or reactions, and then we'll adjourn for lunch. Right. For the Gnostic, did the word evil carry a moral significance, or was it more descriptive? That's a good question, which means you'll get a bad answer, you know. I would say one gets the feeling that it was the latter. It was more descriptive of a condition. Because, you see, if you were one of the souls of the elect, you really couldn't do evil because you didn't have that kind of a soul. And if you were one of the material souls, you really couldn't do good. So it was more a condition. It didn't have to do with the act of the will. Whereas in the Jewish Christian point of view, one lends one's will to evil. And that constitutes sin. How, in the Gnostic scheme of things, did Christ descend into the lower world without being tainted? I don't know of anything that is written about that. I don't recall reading a discussion of that among the fathers. I don't recall anything in the Nag Hammadi library exactly about that. But they probably would say something like, he slipped through the material world like water slips through a tube or something. They probably would use an image like that. Not having been born of a human mother, I think that what they said was that the body in which Jesus inhabited was born through a human mother, but that Christ entered that body afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yet to what degree did the teachings of Valentinus, which are the ones I've summarized, encompass the wide spectrum of Gnostic thinking? There are recognizable similarities in all of the Gnostic schemes. Many of them closely resembled each other. And, like I say, recognizable similarities occurred. But attribute to a feminine entity all these disasters. Now, in the early Christian churches, until it became so formalized, women were also very important. And they also did a great deal of the teaching and had a great, very high standing. In the New Testament, there's a remarkably high standard accorded to women, especially in contrast to the highly patriarchal society in which the church arose. And, of course, in the Judeo-Christian aspect, why Eve had a major role to play in the fall, but the blame was shared with Adam. Well, that's what she says. And I'm aware that's her point of view. But I can only say that I don't think that the ancient literature supports that. Now, I don't doubt that there were Gnostics as well as Christians who had this kind of interior knowledge. Also, there's that little statement she makes in there that those who didn't do that were regarded as inferior, which means that there were those who didn't do it who were inferior or immature. So I don't doubt that there were mature and insightful and sophisticated Gnostics and inferior Gnostics, as there were interior and sophisticated Christians and inferior Christians. But the way that the early Gnostic documents are written supports the idea that these proclaimers of those believe that to be metaphysical cosmological knowledge. I'll read some of that before we're through. Yes, I know. She makes a very strong point. Yes, a very strong point. So you need to remember that. And like I said, read her and read Heller. But then you need to read the documents themselves. And you need to read the Fathers, and then you need to read the... If you really want to get to the bottom of it, then you need to read the Nag Hammadi literature. And then you'll know as much as anybody knows. I think there is an attempt to read back into history some and create some kind of a spiritual super race and a glorified... we always do that from a distance, you know. And if we get disaffected with our own Christian heroes or Jewish heroes, then we'll find them somewhere else. Well, I accept that title with gratitude. Yes, my whole argument in The Kingdom Within is that these parables are interior experience, and that's where they got their power from, and that's where they affected people, and that's why they were retained. That's what they were originally, was understood as interior experience, which would offset Pagel's claim, you see, that all the Christians were rooted into dogmas and creeds and things like that, and all the interior experience belonged to the Gnostics. I think the New Testament itself is a testimony to the opposite. So I don't know what her problem is, but I think she's got something not worked out. But at any rate, why, that's the stand that she's taken, and you've heard my point of view, that I don't think the facts bear it out, and I try to be objective, and now you've heard both sides. Well, that's where we're going to get to right now. You ready? Is there a glass of water back there? I could, or any kind of liquid would be just fine. All right, let's move now to the relationship of Gnosticism to Jungian psychology. Now, if we take Gnosticism as a metaphysical system, it would appear to be hard to understand where there is a relationship between Gnosticism and Jungian ideas. For instance, if we take it as a metaphysical system, then as we've seen, Gnosticism is a form of dualism. And dualism sets one aspect over here and one aspect over there and declares that they have an enmity. And so as we saw, if Gnosticism is incomplete, a metaphysical system, matter and spirit are opposed. The body and sexuality were evil, and the feminine was devalued. Now, I might add to that, by the way, that the body and sexuality really were devalued in Gnosticism. In fact, there were substantial Gnostic sects that forbade marriage, because marriage and procreation would simply transmit more, would further entrap the soul. So, I think that's another piece of evidence that these teachings were not just what Pagel says. They were, in the most extreme Gnostic sects, they were opposed to marriage or any kind of sexuality entirely for these reasons. It became quite concretized. Pardon? He said, what about marriage? Yes, they did, but the Manichaeans did not. So it depended on which group you were with. Now, the idea of a union of these opposites appears to be devoid in Gnostic thought. Now, why then might it be that Jung would see some of the antecedents to his psychology in Gnosticism? Well, in the first place, they did indeed have so many very interesting sayings. The most interesting of their sayings are collected in the Gospel of Thomas, which is well worth reading. The Gospel of Thomas was discovered before was the first one of the Nag Hammadi library to be translated. It appeared in English some time ago, and it contains many. It's a collection of the sayings of Jesus. Now, the interesting thing about these sayings of Jesus is that many of them are identical with what we read in the four Gospels, in the Synoptic Gospels. So you find a repetition of many of the sayings of Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels repeated in the Gospel of Thomas. But then you will also find some sayings in the Gospel of Thomas which we do not find in the four canonical Gospels, but which are preserved for us in this Gnostic Gospel. Here's one of them. Men think perhaps that it is peace which I, this is Jesus speaking, have come to cast upon the world. They do not know that it is dissension which I have come to cast upon the earth. Fire, sword, and war, for there will be five in a house. Three will be against two, and two against three. The father against the son, and the son against the father, and they will stand solitary. Now that statement is very close to Matthew 10, verses 34 through 36. Now the importance of this saying is that it falls into the category of what Edward Edinger calls so aptly in his book, The Anatomy of the Psyche, a separatio statement. And the stages of the alchemical process, about which we'll have more to say in a moment, are the solutio and the separatio and the sublimatio and the others that bear the multiplicatio and the coniunctio. I may have missed one or two. Jung and Edinger of others have shown to be representative of stages of the initiation process. And the separatio stage is a stage in which, in order to arrive at what is truly ourself, we have to separate ourself from others and separate all participation mystique. Most of us live in a state of participation mystique with other people or groups or causes or something of that sort. So we live in a participation mystique with our wife or our husband or whatever it is, or with our political party or with our church or with our cause. And as such, we never arrive at our own individual, unique core. In order to do that, we must do what the Gospel of Thomas here, but also Matthew's Gospel, recommends. And that's why there's this language of the separation, the Father against the Son and the Son against the Father. Then they will stand solitary. And so the emphasis here is then one's own uniqueness, one's own solitariness will be found. Which is to say, see, with the process of individuation, one becomes a unique individual. There is no other individual like us. We are unique in that respect. Therefore, we cannot identify with anybody else and come and arrive at what is ourselves. So there are many sayings like that in the Gospel of Thomas, and they're to be greatly valued and treasured. Now, Jung also saw a lot of psychological importance in the idea of Horus, the setter of limits, very much for the same reason that last night I was suggesting the psychological importance of the Greek goddess who was in charge of boundaries and limits, Themis. Then there's the matter of the interpretation of the story of the Garden of Eden. Now, one Gnostic group, not the Valentinian group, but another one, was known as the Ophites or the Nassines, after the Greek word for a serpent, because they had a totally different view of the Garden of Eden. And their view of the Garden of Eden ran like this. This is a Gnostic group. So they said that the God who created the Garden of Eden and so forth and so on was the Demiurge, which we have seen before, the ignorant God of the Old Testament, not truly God at all. And therefore, for Adam and Eve to become emancipated from his power, they had to step into the Gnosis. And therefore, it was the serpent in the Garden of Eden who was the emissary from the upper world above and called upon, tempted Adam and Eve to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that they might perceive the opposites, you see, and step into exactly this kind of gnosis, this enlightenment that we're talking about, and that then they would see and understand the true state of affairs. So they completely turned the old story of the Garden of Eden upside down. The serpent wasn't the devil. It was the saving God sent down from above. And the good God wasn't the good God, but was the evil, ignorant God forbidding consciousness. On the other hand, the Christian biblical interpreter Origen had a different version of the Garden of Eden story, most unusual version. He said that Adam and Eve originally already had knowledge. God gave it to them from the very beginning, that when they were tempted by the serpent, which he saw as evil, to eat of the fruit, the forbidden fruit, they lost their original capacity for knowledge and stepped into a knowledge of evil. And his point was that one does not know evil from a distance in this sense of the word. We have back to the old intimate sense. They incorporated evil into themselves by eating that fruit. And the result was evil became in them and they lost their original clear knowledge. So that's an alternative way of interpreting the scripture from a mystical interpreter of the early church, Origen. That's the way these people thought. But there was that, and so Jung saw in that image of the Nassines the importance of the birth of consciousness, and that there's something forbidden about coming into consciousness, but then one could know the opposites of good and evil. And he valued that story, and it's a good point. Now, Jung also objected or valued Gnosticism partly because of the importance that it placed upon the reality of evil. You see, the material world was evil. The Demiurge was evil and so forth. And he has, if you read Jung, you know that he objects widely to the Christian idea that evil is the privation of the good. And so by saying evil is the privation of the good, you say that evil has no reality in and of itself apart from the good. And he felt that that weakened an appreciation of the reality of evil and was quite upset at this whole idea. And therefore, for that reason, he valued the Gnostic emphasis upon evil and apparently was willing to pay the price of the dualism that this brought. Now, we don't want to get too much into the doctrine of the privatio boni, but it's a subtle doctrine. And what it says is that only the good exists in and of itself. In the old philosophical terminology, only the good has substance. The evil lives off the good, which does not mean that it does not exist. It just means that it can't exist apart from the good. An analogy would be a disease. So someone has smallpox. Now, the smallpox virus, the disease of smallpox, exists only insofar as there is a more or less healthy body for it to infect. If the body dies, the patient dies, the disease dies with it. The disease cannot exist apart from the host. That would be an analogous idea, which we also find in places of the I Ching. So I don't want to sound apologetic for the Christian position in this regard, but I think that we should set the matter straight. Anybody who can read the pages of the New Testament and wind up with the idea that the Christian perspective thinks that evil isn't real, I simply can't believe how it could possibly be the case. It's the main subject on practically every page we read. And the devil is an ever-present reality, not to mention all his demons. So I don't quite understand this, but anyway, Jung got quite upset about the privatio boni, and I'm not out particularly to defend that doctrine of the privatio boni. It's not a very important doctrine to me, except to point out the subtlety and the reasoning of it. But that's one reason why, so it is said, that he favored Gnosticism, because it clearly established the reality of evil. Now, then there is also another, well, it's not just another, but the whole Gnostic doctrine, as we've seen, is of the particles of light or spirit from the upper world that have, for the reasons we explained, wound up in the lower world and now exist in the souls of the elect. And it is these particles of light, as we have seen, which must be extricated and refined from their contamination with material reality and restored to the pleroma. Now, Jung felt that this was analogous to that aspect of the individuation process that we call the separatio, and which is an essential part, where we've already touched upon it before, but again, it's a matter of separating things out. Separating things out that hitherto were unconsciously contaminated with each other. And he felt that in this Gnostic image of the separating out of the sparks of light from their being obscured in gross material reality, that he saw a very important psychological operation. So in other words, if you take the Gnostic imagery psychologically symbolic of the individuation process, it comes up with these valuable things. If you take it as a doctrine in competition with a Christian or a Jewish or other kind of doctrine, then it looks somewhat different. Unfortunately, Jung isn't very clear about these things when he kind of gets on the bandwagon about something. He doesn't keep his he needs Horus more, the limits. If he discusses Gnosticism, he doesn't always say, "Now I'm regarding this now as a body of psychological imagery." And one suspects one is back in the old controversy about metaphysical systems. Jung is the same way, I find, when he talks about God. First, Jung will, this is one of my pet peeves with Jung. I don't have very many, but I have a few. When he'll begin by saying, "Now when I talk about God, I'm not talking about God, I'm talking about the image of God in the soul. It's not theology, it's psychology." And so we agree that that's fine to do. Then he goes on and talks about God exactly as it was, though it was theology he was talking about. He does this over and over again in his book, Answer to Job. He'll make the disclaimer, and then he talks exactly as though he's talking about the God that you and I are talking about if we talk about God, or the ultimate reference point of the universe. It becomes very irritating. You get the idea he wants his cake to have his cake and eat it too. Now you see, if he really wanted to be careful, he wouldn't use the term God. He would say, "I'm not talking about God, therefore I'll use the term the self." Then it'll be clear, neat, and distinct. So this gets all the theologians very much up in arms, and I must say they have a point. And then Jung always gets his feelings hurt and say, "They're always misunderstanding me." So I don't know what kind of a game he had going there. It would have been very easy to have resolved that misunderstanding simply by not taking... In other words, if I were to say, "Now, when I talk about your mother, you need to understand, I'm not really referring to your mother. I'm talking about this over here, and then if I go on to calumniate your mother, it might be just a little hard for you to keep remembering. Oh, he doesn't mean my mother when he says that. So we have that kind of a difficulty when we get into Jung. I get the feeling sometimes he really wants to be a theologian, but doesn't want to be held responsible for it or something. But otherwise, I'm a great admirer of Dr. Jung, so don't get me wrong. Yes? I will say that again. Yes? Right? Go back the other way. Well, I suspect that he was, but I don't think he was acknowledging that. I think he was denying that he was. I don't think he could ever quite leave those issues alone. Yes, I read that book. What Murray fails to mention is that with Jung's treatment of Christianity, Jung treated Christianity very well, but unfortunately the patient died. Okay, that's a good point. Essentially, I think that's where I was making the point, that it's very easy, even though we make disclaimers, to, without knowing it, slip from one position to another position. And that's what I personally believe that Jung has done in many of his writings, especially Answer to Job. I don't know, maybe I've done it too. Have I done that? Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. I found out that I'm a sort of a clinician too, and when I get to my practice, I'm very clinical, but I never can quite give up all the other fascinating questions about human existence, which continue to fascinate me, and the many attempts we make to unravel the total meaning of things. Sure. Oh, the war. All right. Okay. Let me quick, dutifully finish some of these ideas of Jung. Okay. The Demiurge. In the image of the Demiurge, Jung believed that one can see the ego. He saw the Demiurge personifying the ego, which ignorantly tries to dominate its small world and is unconscious of the larger reality of the self. I can quote from Jung. We find this in Ion, page 189. The ignorant demiurge illustrates the perplexity of the ego when it can no longer hide from itself the knowledge that it has been dethroned by a supraordinate authority. So there again is another example of Jung seeing in Gnosticism very important psychological images, with which I would quite agree. Jung also valued the description of the upper world, the pleroma, as being consisting of syzygies of opposites. All the ions were paired in these masculo-feminine pairs of opposites. And also the number system, the original tetrad and the ogdoad and then the 10 and then the 30 and so forth. He felt that in those descriptions that we were seeing a symbolic structural representation of the archetype of the self and the ground of all consciousness. So there's another way of valuing the Gnostic imagery as making important psychological statements without confusing it with a cosmological system. He felt that the light of the upper world in Gnostic cosmological systems symbolizes psychologically that the self, that is, the pleroma, is the origin of all consciousness. So that the light of the ego originates from the self as the origin of all consciousness. Another very important psychological image. He felt that the idea of Sophia's Akamoth, which fell down into the material world and became trapped and had to be rescued, was symbolic of the idea that the self must be redeemed and won back from an originally unconscious condition. Another good idea of the perception of psychological, or if you like, mystical import in Gnostic images. Okay, yes. Here the idea is the Akamoth, Sophia's, her enthumesis that becomes Akamoth in the material world, which became entrapped in the material world, and yet that Akamoth contained the spiritual lights from above, the lost lights, and how all of that light had to be won back. So his idea here is that in this image is expressed the fact that the self must be redeemed. That is a portion of the self represented here by the Akamoth, from an originally unconscious condition. Now that's a Jungian idea, that the self must be redeemed, cries out for redemption. So in Gnosticism, the spiritual light in Akamoth cries out for redemption from this condition in which it finds itself. Now, another intriguing thought is the matter of the unknowability of the Father in Gnosticism. You will recall that the Father cannot be described. He is without a second. He is a totality, and he is without a second. And therefore, he is without consciousness. Now, this gets into some very subtle thinking. In Jung's idea of the description of the Father, the original Father, Boothos, in Gnosticism. You recall that Boothos in Gnosticism, the original father, was without, I didn't exactly say he was without consciousness, but he could not be described. Now, Jung kind of extrapolates from that. I'm not sure he can really justify it. The notion that the Boothos in Gnosticism is without any consciousness or awareness. Very much like the idea of Brahman in Hindu thought. It's hard to know whether the idea of Brahman, who is one without a second, can be thought to have anything like consciousness. Now, Jung extrapolated from this the notion that God is unconscious. Now, is he talking about the metaphysical God? Is he talking about the self? He isn't too clear what he's talking about. Like it was pointed out over here, he's kind of a moving back and forth between one level and another level. You don't always know from what level he's speaking about. But he says the self is unconscious. In fact, he goes on so far as to say, in places as in Ion and all throughout Answer to Job, that God is unconscious, unconscious of himself, unconscious of everything, that only the human ego is conscious. And therefore he argues that this gives a certain superiority to the human ego, which God does not have, and which he envies. And therefore, God, in order to become conscious, must become fully incarnated in man. That's the way Jung talks. Remember the answer to Job. Now, I don't know whether the self is conscious or not. I rather think it is. But it brings up the tantalizing notion as to whether the ego has an exclusive claim on consciousness. Fascinating question. Jung seems to say, yes, that the only thing in the whole universe or in all reality that has consciousness is the ego. And he argues that Such descriptions of God as we find in the Gnostic descriptions of Boethos argue that since God has no second to be conscious of, there can be no consciousness. Now, at that point, I have to object to a presumptuous going beyond the bounds of our epistemology. I would say there is no way we can possibly know what else might have consciousness. And there's some fascinating contemporary explorations of the locus of consciousness, which some of you, I can see as you nod your head, are familiar with. Where is consciousness to be located? We usually think of consciousness being located inside the particular entity in some way. Yet, for instance, whether we want to call it consciousness or not, we at least must call it intelligence. The intelligence in forms of insect life, which have a highly social organization, do not lie in the individual insect, but in the group. So if you observe termites at work, or you observe ants at work, or bees at work, and study carefully the movements of the individual bee, you realize that the center is not in the bee, it's in the group. And if the size of that insect population is reduced below a certain point, the constituent members no longer know what to do. It's a fascinating thought. The same way with these little fish, where it's hundreds of little fish, you know, that go swimming through the water. They go like that, and then they all go like that, and then they all go like that. And there seems to be no discernible leader that gives any signal. Suddenly, a center in the school of fish itself operates. And this is only one among many very daring ideas about consciousness and the locus of consciousness that we're finding. A good little resume of them is made by Michael Talbot in a little book called Beyond the Quantum. And there's a place in there where he discusses these new ideas of the locus of consciousness. So as far as I'm concerned, what consciousness is and the locus of consciousness is up for grabs, but I would never presume that this little ego I carry around is the only thing that has consciousness. How consciousness works in other forms of life, I simply don't know. Well, right. Well, I think that's Jung's point, and you put it quite well. For those of you who couldn't hear, it's a restatement of a very good restatement of the idea that consciousness requires something to be conscious of and an interaction with a second. An analogy was drawn to the analytical encounter and between the therapist and the analysand. And I would say that certainly consciousness, as we understand it, I think requires that. And nevertheless, I would like to say that does somehow for me does not negate the idea that there can be a cosmic consciousness without a second. Now, don't ask me how that's possible. I merely suggest that I don't think the one refutes the possibility of the other. Now, the mystics have asserted the latter is the case. As they describe their entrance into what they regard to be the reality of God, they describe it as a stepping into a consciousness. So I think that's a good position as far as it goes on a certain created order. But when it comes to the uncreated, I don't think we can say. Oh, a proof. All right. The question is raised, is it when we talk about consciousness existing when one consciousness meets its object or responding consciousness, and the question is raised, is that an argument for the necessity of a confrontation with another to have consciousness, or is it a proof of consciousness, right? Okay. mystical tradition, and in many, many traditions, including the Christian and the Jewish, has always argued the all-knowingness of God. So one finds that throughout the Old and in the with the Jewish scripture and the New Testament, that it was, it's interesting in the Bible to study how that idea emerged. But emerge it did, that God was all-knowing, that nothing escaped the knowledge of God. And it was one way in which in the Bible what we would call the idea of the unconscious began to emerge. Yes, the ego may deny things, but they are known somewhere, as we discover when we get into our own unconscious psyche, and suddenly everything there has been known. Now that statement that God is the knower of hearts, and that nothing escapes the knowledge of God, could be taken as an exclusively psychological statement, namely that everything that happens on the level of the ego is registered also on the level of the self and is known there in some way. And I think that would be quite valid. The secrets of all hearts will be disclosed when the unconscious is revealed, you see. It's only the ego that kids itself. But it can also be taken in a more cosmological way, that there may be a knowing of all things that exists in some other dimension that on our merely human dimension we cannot imagine. Fascinating issues and questions that can't, of course, be finally answered. Yes? Mm-hmm. 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 All right, let's see if I understand what you're saying. You're saying there can be such a thing as a collective ego, right? All right. So in a time of war, for instance, we may have a collective ego, right? I would agree with that. Now, what? Yes. Yes, something like that. All right. Right. All right. Or could you all understand that? That in other words, in the Old Testament, the Ark of the Lord could be seen as their God, and that might represent the collective ego of the people, right? Now, I think such a state would be exist when there is this participation mystique that Jung talks about, when we are unconsciously identified with others and unconscious of having any individual identity of our own and not willing to take that responsibility. Then there is a kind of something like a corporate ego does indeed function. I would agree. Other words I might use for my sense of God. I would say the awareness of the numinous, that the numinous is the sense of God. Are you familiar with that word, numinous? Okay. Right. 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 Or do I continue to personify it in my own mind? Well, I would say that when I'm thinking as a philosopher, of course, I don't. But on the practical level, it works best if you personify it. And then you can talk to God. You see, you can talk to this reality. And so that's what we find happening in mystical tradition. It lends itself to personification.
You think what?
Never mind. Well, I would say that when I'm thinking as a philosopher, of course, I don't. But on the practical level, it works best if you personify it. And then you can talk to God. You see, you can talk to this reality. And so that's what we find happening in mystical tradition. It lends itself to personification. Now, if you really start to think about it and say, you know, can one really talk to the God, the ultimate author of the universe, and so forth and so on, then you can't. Now, on the psychological level, of course, one can talk with the self. The self speaks with a voice, as it were. So psychologically, it's valid to talk to God and hear what God has to say to you. Metaphysically, we're in another ballgame. Well, we should be getting ready to adjourn. Somebody wanted to get into the war just a little bit, and of course, I'm always glad to ventilate about the war. First, of course, I have to admit, very humbly admit, that I could be wrong, and maybe the war is the correct course of action. And that could well be so. It's one of those instances in which I would genuinely like to be wrong. But my reaction is being aghast on all kinds of levels. Aghast because I think there were other ways that Iraq could have been contained, and the power of Iraq to cause more mischief and danger could have been abrogated and cut off, and that we lacked the patience for that. Patience, by the way, is a great virtue, which comes from having ego stability. Jung himself once said that the devil is beaten with patience. And there's the old saying that haste is of the devil. I think the United States has got to cure itself of its inflation and renounce the world, the role of seeing itself as policeman or the regulator of the moral order, especially when we have no examination of our own shadow. I think such a role is a disaster. And I also am aghast because I see Saddam Hussein as the creation of Western powers. The Germans apparently supplied the wherewithal for the chemical operations, and the Swiss and Honeywell organization, according to the papers, helped him with his atomic energy research, and the French armed him and built the underground tunnels in which he probably is taking refuge. The Kuwaitis bankrolled him during the Iran war, and we cheered him on because he was our bad guy. He was our bad guy who was beating up on that other bad guy. And so without the West, he would not be where he is. Having that we created Frankenstein's monster, and then he turned around and bit our hand. So all of a sudden, this crazy posture we have is so frighteningly unconscious. If we just went in with a more naked thing, well, I guess we goofed that time, and we created this, and now we've got to kill it. I could handle it better. It's this rhetoric that I think is so mind-numbing that only something really bad can come of it. Now, I also am a patriotic American, and I don't see a single American interest that is at stake because of what Iraq is doing if we were to take steps to protect Saudi Arabia. We do not need the oil from Kuwait. We can get plenty of oil without it. We even have our own domestic reserves of oil. There's a great deal of it still in the ground. It's just too expensive to get it up. It's too far down. At a fraction of the cost of a war, however, we could subsidize the oil industry and we could bring it up. Not to mention the fact, of course, that 8 years ago we had an excellent energy conservation program going. We could be by this time, if we continued it, operating our automobiles on ethanol and other substitutes, which I understand work quite well, and for which we have ample resources. And we put our minds to it, we could do it again. In fact, regardless of how the war turns out, I think if we don't do it, and if we continue to remain dependent on Arab oil, we're on for a disaster. I understand that Japan is not contributing to the war because they don't see a problem. I read an article that said in the last 10 years they've cut their oil consumption down 50% by economizing. And they can easily afford to pay a little bit more for Arab oil if that's necessary. That seems to be their position. We could be in the same position. So suddenly to turn this into a great sacred holy war in the face of these things. So then, of course, there's my feeling function. There will be young men and maybe young women, too, coming back in the body bags. And you can bet your dollar it'll be a worse war than we think. But, you know, it's not only... I also don't think it's healthy to kill Iraqis. I read an article by a Vietnam veteran in the paper. He was against the war, and he was against it on this basis. He says, you know, never forget the way you win a war is you kill people. You keep killing them and killing them and killing them until the other side doesn't want to have any more people killed. Then you win. And he said, this can go on a long time. If the Soviet Union lost 20 million people, and it was still fighting. It wouldn't stop. He says, how many Iraqis do we have to kill to win? 10,000? 100,000? 500,000? How many are we willing to kill? And we have no idea how many we will have to kill to win the war. Now, I don't think you can go around killing 500,000 Iraqis, even if you don't like Iraqis, and get away with it on the inside. I think that there's a rebound, a psychological karma and a rebound. I think that spiritually it could be ruinous, especially with this self-serving rhetoric that we've got going. And then the final reason is that I'm a patriotic American. I don't think America can afford a war. We haven't paid for the last war. And we have this enormous debt. And, of course, while we're fighting a war, we can run away from all the really difficult problems, the social problems, the financial problems. Well, thank God, we don't have to worry about them anymore. They're the hard problems. And we can lose ourselves in this war. When we get through, there's going to be a great big bill to pay. And the only way to pay for it is to raise taxes. Well, of course, no politician is going to vote for raising taxes, so we'll add it to the debt. And your children, my children, will pay that. I see this as the path toward the destruction of America. I don't think it's irreversible, but we're on the way out. You know, it's very interesting that to see what's happened to the nations of the world after World War II. The two nations that have deteriorated in strength are the Soviet Union and the United States. Because the basis of all military strength, not to mention other strength, is the health of an economy. And we are the ones, the Soviet Union's economy, of course, is apparently a ruin, but our economy is eroding rapidly from the inside. So I see America, whether we win or not, well, we will win. They all tell us we'll win, so I guess we will. I see it as the weakening of America. By the time we get back and all the flag waving is over and all the cheers and all the grave solemn ceremonies for the poor soldiers who died, and all the extolling the marvelous merits of our weapons and how great the Patriot missiles worked after all, and aren't those F-15s marvelous, we will be the weaker. Our strength will be that much weaker. So I'm just, frankly, I am just aghast about it. I hope, honest to God, I hope I'm wrong. I'm just aghast. And I think I'm aghast because I'm a patriotic American. So that's kind of the way I feel about it. I'm glad to have a chance to ventilate. Yes, for every 5 injuries, 1 soldier comes down with battle fatigue. He becomes the casualty. He has to bear the psychological brunt of all of this. Yes. Now, psychologically, I think what we have here is the old problem of the unintegrated shadow. Nobody wants to face their shadow. Collectively, we don't want to face our shadow. The way not to face the shadow is to project it onto the enemy. So now, Saddam Hussein is the carrier of the shadow. And he's a bad man. There's no question about it. He's a good one to project it onto. But as long as we project it onto Saddam Hussein, we don't have to face it in ourselves. And there's a great big old American shadow eating away at the core of our country, right down from the government right on down through the whole society. And we're not dealing with it. Thank God we have a war. Now we don't have to deal with it. The shadow's over there, and we can be the noble heroes again. It's a psychological disaster. No, there wasn't a commitment, but we were uncomfortable. We were at least uncomfortable about America. We knew something was wrong. We couldn't get away from it. Well, no, I think that World War II was, I'm not against all war. I think it sometimes is a necessity. I just don't think that this one's a necessity. Now, in World War II, you will remember we were attacked. And also, I think the comparisons between Hussein and Adolf Hitler are ludicrous. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I see. Yes, I suppose that's part of the price of war. You can't wage war without doing a lot of projecting. That's right. So even a war that I think was perhaps inevitable and could be justified, like World War II, it certainly inevitably involves these projections. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, now that we're in it, I don't... Once the dogs of war are unloosed, I don't think you can go back. And so this archetype gets going. See, the other one's the projection of the shadow, and the other is the energy generated by the archetype of Aries or war. And in our rationalistic age, we don't believe in such things, you know? But it's there. And once this energy gets unleashed and there's no more controls for it or limits, one doesn't know what will happen. So we already see, of course, the Iraqis, apparently, they probably will do everything they can to create ruin before they finally finished off. And there will be massive destruction because this energy is going. You know, there's a wonderful Greek myth, the myth of Cadmus and the dragon. And there's this terrible dragon, you know, and Cadmus slew the dragon. But the story was that if someone took the teeth of the dragon and sowed them in the ground, well, which happened with Jason in the story of Jason and Medea, Jason was required to sow the teeth of the dragon in the ground. Then from where each tooth sprang up, there would come a fully armed warrior. And that these soldiers would keep fighting and fighting and fighting. Nothing could stop them. The dragon here, the blood of the dragon, representing this kind of energy. And it's all right until somebody takes the seed of it and puts it in the ground. Then up it comes again in the form not just of war, but of this destruction. And that's what we've done. And unfortunately, since everybody's much too rational to believe such things as crazy old Greek myths, why, we all think we can handle it rationally. Cadmus dragon? I'm not sure it was sacred to Ares. Oh, it was. Okay. Good point. Athena, who could go about a nice cold way. Right, so these are the things that frighten me. Oh dear. How would I define evil? And would I call what's going on now as evil? Well, I would call what's going on now as evil. Right, now that's speaking from my feeling function. Now, if I had to define it, yeah, you're the first person to ever ask me that. I don't know how I define it. I would say, I suppose, that evil would work for the obliteration of consciousness, and that it would work for the obliteration of the creative. But that's a little detached as a definition, but off the hand, I'd say that that's what it is. All right, she defines evil as that which keeps us separated, keeps the conscious and the unconscious separated, and which splits the wholeness. I'd go along with that. Well, yes. Well, fortunately for me, it's my intuition and my intellect that roams around up here in these far-reaching questions, but when it comes down to the gutty side of life, my feeling function comes up with something. And I have a feeling reaction, so I thank God for my feeling function. One more, and then I'll close with a comforting quote from a friend of mine. A couple hands, and then we'll take it. Yes? All right, that's interesting. Yes? Yes. Yes, the three books, yes. When I first contacted Dr. Kunkel, before I even met him, I contacted him by letter, and he wrote back and said he'd see me, and then he said, start writing down your dreams. That was a brand new idea. I never thought about that in my life. I didn't know I even had dreams. Well, I was having a flood of them. And the three books, let's say, one was Jung's Modern Man in Search of a Soul, and the other was Francis Wickie's book, The Inner World of Man, and the third was Fritz's own book, Creation Continues. Those were the three books. Well, they'd all be real good books. I don't know whether I would pick those three out first of all, but they're, each one of them is just as good as it was the day it was written, and it was real good then. All right, last comforting statement in the face of the world situation comes from my friend Robert Johnson. Many of you might know Robert and his writings, and a very interesting and unique person. We lunch together quite often when he's not in India, which is where he is right now. And he once said to me, well, he said, you know, the world isn't supposed to work. He said, what it's supposed to be is an arena in which individual consciousness can develop, and that it does very well. So with that comforting comment, I thank you. The Nag Hammadi Library, I heartily recommend it. So you read that, and then you can decide whether Elaine has gone a little too far or I've gone a little too far.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.